Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. It is the 29th of August. The sun is rising and the Son of God, Jesus Christ, has risen. And that is good news. Indeed, it is, in fact, the central good news that we start with each morning here on Faith Radio Mornings, declaring this truth that is 2,000 years old, but no less relevant, that because Jesus has been raised, that tomb is empty and there is always hope and always future in his beautiful kingdom. And this is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Happy to be joined in studio. I mention them often, Logan Rausch and Paul Perreault, who help produce the show, keep this news flowing, keep the guests coming and the sound running. They do such a great job behind the scenes for you as listeners, just keeping the show moving smoothly forward. Grateful to be on the team with them and, of course, with all of you around the Midwest and East Coast and streaming around the country. It's just great to gather together as believers like this in the morning, start our day, whether we're just getting up or already off to work or getting our kids to school, which will be happening in a couple of days as well. So it's good. Just love getting up this way. It's not always fun to get up in the morning this early, but to be part of conversations in the news from a Christian perspective and important matters of faith and family and church. And I'm excited to see who we have come into the program each day. And that includes this morning with our first guest, Keith Getty, who will be joining the Faith Radio Morning Show in just a few moments. And if you don't know Keith's name, you'll likely know one of the songs that he co-wrote, In Christ Alone, which is a song that many of us sing in our churches these days. It makes me cry every time we sing it in church. It's this profound expression of worship. And Keith and his wife, Christine, work around the world inspiring congregations as part of their Sing campaign to truly worship God in music. And worship is so central to our life together. By comparison, sermons only really started in the church in the 16th century with the Protestant Reformation. They sort of moved the communion table out of the center of the service, the Protestants did, and they moved the pulpit into the center. And so we've only had sermons for about 400 years or so, but worship has always, by comparison, been central to our faith. So a few quotes this morning by theologians of note. A.W. Tozer says that without worship, we go about miserable. C.S. Lewis writes, "The most valuable thing the Psalms do for me is to express the same delight in God which made David dance." And William Temple, Archbishop of Canterbury in 1942, wrote this, that worship is the submission of all of our nature to God. It is the quickening of conscience by his holiness, the nourishment of our minds with his truth, the purifying of imagination by his beauty, the opening of the heart to his love, and the surrender of our wills to his purpose. And we all gather together, gathered up in adoration. And so once again, we declare this morning that Jesus is risen and that God is worthy of all praise. Keith Getty next on Faith Radio Mornings.
In Christ alone, who took on flesh, fullness of God in heaven.
That, of course, is the music co-written by Keith Getty, his wife Christine. They travel the world as part of the Sing campaign to just help us as congregations in our churches learn to worship again, just wholeheartedly our God, such an important part of our faith. Good morning, Keith. Thanks for joining us here on Faith Radio Mornings.
Good morning. It's an honor to be on. Thank you.
So just give our listeners a little sense of what is behind the Sing campaign, just what you do sort of day in and day out. I know you travel around between Ireland and Nashville and other places in the world. How did you get this whole thing started?
Well, I mean, I guess the slightly longer story, as you mentioned already, is that my wife and I have been writing modern hymns since the year 2000. And of course, the first one we wrote with Stuart Turner was In Christ Alone, which opened some doors to just continue this as our life's work, which was wonderful. And we were coming up to the year of I guess the Reformation, the 500th anniversary with Luther. And of course, one of the things Luther, as you rightly mentioned, singing and worship has been with the church all through history, the Old Testament, New Testament, throughout the church fathers. but it did disappear in the church for a number of years. And Luther said, as I read the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Church Fathers, I realize that God, that our faith is learned in significant part through what we sing. In other words, it's not just preaching. And many of my friends with the Reformation, many of my friends indeed generally with the Neo-Reform movement and with the likes of Dr. Piper and these other good Minnesotans who really resurrected preaching again, were getting very excited about how to really resurrect preaching, but nobody was really talking about singing doctrinal songs. So he thought, let's create a conference. End of book, cold team. Sorry, it's early morning. Early morning, you on there?
Sorry, it's very early morning. I yawn too in these mornings, Keith.
in the year 2017, and so that's what we did, and we were overwhelmed by the response. And really, it was basically looking at how singing affects you and I as individuals. How it affects our families, you know, our marriages and our children, how it affects our churches and the people who we share life with there, and ultimately then how it affects, you know, our mission to the world and our wider communities.
Well, and singing like this, it really taps into a different part of our spiritual journey, I think, in such important ways. And I know that worship can be a source of division, consternation in churches, where people get concerned about whether or not it's an organ or drums or electric guitar. I mean, that's even divided churches historically so often. But the invitation in worship is not necessarily about the style of the music. It is about what it does for us in our relationship with one another and with God.
That's right. It's a holy privilege. It's something that we're actually created to do. The Bible says we're created to sing His praise, but it also commands us. So it's an act of obedience. It's the second most common command in Scripture to sing. It's important to remember as we prepare for church on a Saturday night and on a Sunday morning, getting ready for it and then going into church, that we sing because of command. Most of all, we sing because the gospel compels us. When we think of what Christ has done for us, when we think of what it means to be lost and then find, to be blind but being able to see, for all that Christ has achieved for us. I always think of the old Irish missionary, Amy Carmichael, who said, "How can I keep from singing?"
And when we are in those places, I think, too, when it just doesn't feel like there's a lot of energy or even hope around our faith, there's something about music that it just in general music just sort of wakes up the soul. It is that art that is part of our journey that we need. And boy, when you combine the doctrine that you do with the art of worship, I've got to believe it's a powerful experience for you, even as you write.
That's right. But I mean, it's as you said, it affects everyone in different at so many different levels. You know, yesterday morning, my pastor, who's also my neighbor, one of my closest friends, to be with his father-in-law, whose dementia, sadly, is getting perhaps to its last days. And they're having some difficult times, but he can still respond to hymns because he sang them throughout his life. You know, I have raised four girls here, the ages of 7, 4, 3, and 5 months. And my three-year-old, earlier in the year, when she was two, we took about 100 days out just to set the Psalms to music. And so my three-year-old, when she was then two, was able to start singing. She actually knew the words of Psalm 8 almost in totality just by singing that song as we wrote it in the house and hearing it. So just the idea that as I write the Psalms, as she set the Psalms to music, that my girls are memorizing the book of Psalms because of melodies.
And I think I would imagine, Keith, that just even around family devotions, it's got. I would love to be part of your family devotions with your three girls. I can't sing a note. I've never even met a note that I've heard before. And so to be part of your family devotions, it's got to be great around the dinner table, right?
Well, it is. But I will say this: that you know, the Lord has given us all different talents. But the Lord has asked all of us to sing, and this is an important thing we emphasize to our friends. You know, we're not. It's not that our voices are professional standard, it's that they're confessional standard. In other words, it's that Christ has saved us. So we all sing, whether we're Pavarotti, whether we're Donna, or whether we're Zach's dad. Zach's a member of our band, and his siblings are all involved in music and the arts professionally. And they got it from their parents. Their dad was the most passionate singer in their church. He used to get excited about hymns. He sang them all week. And he'd be a big, burly Texan who sang very loud and was very obvious in his little polite Midwestern church. But he only had two notes. He could sing just these two notes. He was almost entirely tone deaf. But the witness and the example that was to his family was to do that. You know, it's so important, you know, if we're going to be serious fathers and serious mothers, that what we sing, both actually sing, and even the music in our homes, as listened to the New England Puritans, actually contemporaries of Jonathan Edwards, heroes of Dr. Piper, your pastor. You know, they wouldn't let a man take communion on a Sunday if he wasn't singing with his family every day. And interestingly, earlier in our career, when we first had Eliza, we were having just an awful time. We were totally overwhelmed. We were just two selfish firstborn children married to each other who had been touring the world, and suddenly with this baby, we didn't know what to do. And at first, I aren't very practical. And I had to go to Cloth. We were doing a show in California, and Dr. John MacArthur was meeting for coffee. I was meeting him for coffee, and I met him, and of course, he looks at me and says, "You look stressed." And I said, just as a flippant comment, "Have you any advice on raising children?" And he goes, "In a lot of ways, it starts with the songs that you fill your home with." And he didn't go to theology. He didn't go to doctrine. He didn't go to catechizing. He didn't go to education. He didn't go to discipline. But he went to filling your home with songs of the Lord first. Now, that might have been in part because he was talking to me, but I find it very significant. You know, just the significance he put on the fact that they filled each of their cars with cassettes in their day of songs of the Lord. They filled where life happened in the home. They filled it with songs of the Lord in the kitchen, in the playroom, you know, in the bedrooms at nighttime. Where life happened, they filled them with songs of the Lord. So it's a huge thing. In our house, we do prayers in the morning and every night, and then at nighttime. And then we quite often just play CDs of Christian songs, so they can mostly kids' songs, so that they can sing fun songs to dance to some days or whatever. Then in the evening we do prayers, and then we do a hymn of the month. So we teach the hymn each month, and it's fantastic. But you know what, Eliza, to your point about standard, Eliza sings "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty." She sings it absolutely perfectly. She's a very serious firstborn, always wanting to please her parents. Then Charlotte, our maverick middle one, she'll sing, but she'll lose her concentration in the middle and shrug her shoulders and say, "No, I don't care," because she has to be different from her sister. Then Gracie, our youngest, one day she says, "Can I sing a solo?" And I said, "Sure." So she went, "Holy, holy, holy, how I wonder what you are, up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky. Holy, 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 blessed Trinity." And the point is, as a dad, you just adore them all. And I think it's a good picture of how our Lord looks at our singing. So, I mean, whether it's 4.0 or whether it's 0.1, you know, he delights in the praises of his children's heart. That's a very long answer. So let's apologize.
No. That is a lovely story, Keith. And I think, you know, so many of us as parents and grandparents listening can really just identify with those sorts of stories with our kids. It's a lovely invitation. It's Keith Getty of the Sing Campaign, and you would know him as co-writing "In Christ Alone," a real popular hymn that is doctrinally sound that is through our churches today. We'll take a short break. And Keith, when we come back, I'm going to ask you about I get a lot of comments from my students that I teach that maybe worship is not reliable, that it is just sort of this emotional thing and we're not actually touching with the presence of God. So I would love your thoughts and comments on that when we come back next on Faith Radio Mornings. Of course, the music of Keith and Christine Getty, part of the Sing Campaign, music that they write for churches, wonderful worship songs, doctrinally sound, just filled with the wonder and the beauty of God. This is Dr. Peter Kapsner on Faith Radio Mornings, and joined on the line by Keith Getty. We've been talking about the importance of worship in our journey, not just as something that sort of preludes the sermon, but it's always been central to our faith. And Keith, I love just the invitation to have music playing throughout our homes. I know it's really easy these days with devices like Amazon Echo or Google, and that we can actually, we find ourselves streaming and shuffling Andrew Peterson or Fernando Ortega through our house as we're making dinner and those kinds of things. It's just to surround and immerse your house in music is a beautiful invitation, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And those are two wonderful guys. Andrew's obviously going to be at the Sing Conference with us next week. And Fernando, we're hoping to have next year. He was in the Christmas tour with us. And my wife says, Fernando Ortega has helped four of our children sleep in their baby years, because his voice is just so stunning, and his choice of songs is so extraordinarily tasteful, that as we have gone through these baby years with our girls, I don't know how many times you've listened to Fernando Ortega. So I highly recommend both Andrew and Fernando.
Yeah, they
so much so that I forgot. So much so that I've actually forgotten your question.
I know. We do get swept up. But to your point, we have often played Fernando in the evenings for our kids as they're going to sleep, and they actually begin to ask for it. They can hear it playing down maybe in our kitchen as they're going to sleep, and there's something just really peaceful about that. It's one of the many dimensions of music that really calls us to life in ways that other parts of our faith really can't, right?
No, absolutely. We talked earlier about how it affects, you know, a child before they can necessarily understand what they're singing, but plants the songs deep in them, and similarly how it affects a person with dementia who no longer knows what his daughter looks like.
Yeah, it's
but clings to those songs because they sung them through their lives. And it's another example of why what we sing is important. People often say it's just the words are important, the music's just a vehicle. And at one level, the music is just a vehicle, but actually art is important because it's important to God. So if we sing well-written hymns that will stand the test of time, I mean, even taking it from a devotional point of view or a pastoral point of view, that has a far greater effect in your spiritual life than singing contemporary worship songs, because almost no contemporary worship songs will last. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're very valuable for this moment, and I have been a beneficiary of them every year of my Christian life. But just a reminder to people, we did an interview with J.I. Packer for Sing this year, and I quoted him, of course, in his introduction to Among God's Giants, where he so skillfully introduced so many of us to the Puritans again. And I said, in the introduction to that book, you talk about reading two books by a dead person to read one book by a new person. And he goes, yes, that's because we want to read contemporary books because we want to be relevant. But something written by somebody who's dead is more relevant. I said, well, how does that apply to church music? And he actually said, I think church music should really be more like 3-1. He said, because modern writing is so shabby.
Mm.
Yeah. So just an important lesson for us. The songs that Fernando's singing, the songs that Pensioner is singing right now, you know, are songs that will last for the most part.
They really are. And I think so often we maybe confuse relevance with sounding like the culture today, as opposed to relevance being those deep central realities of truth of the kingdom that even though people have passed for 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000 years, it's still relevant. It's part of why we on Faith Radio Mornings often start our mornings with quotes from ancient theologians to remind ourselves that this journey of faith is not just the last 5 minutes. Right. It's been this anchored journey, and music calls us into that. And Keith, I'd be curious just to get your thought. We just have a couple minutes left here in terms of sometimes I hear the objection from my students that, you know, worship just kind of gets us an emotional high. We're not actually connecting with the presence of God. And because I know I'm so often moved during worship. Am I just experiencing emotions here, Keith, or does God's presence really intersect with us in those moments in some ways that just other things can't get to?
Well, that's certainly a very complex issue. It would take a number of minutes to complain. And obviously, you and my very close charismatic friends would hold a different view to some of our very close, you know, Sydney Anglican friends or Baptist or Presbyterian friends here in America. So I don't necessarily want to do a massive debate, but it is true that it is certainly more than just singing. And singing has got a deep spiritual connection with all of us that moves us and should move us, which is because we're spiritual beings. It's in part why beauty is important, but it's also in part why, but also in part this thing which happens in singing. When singing happens, how it connects and transforms people's lives.
And it's Keith Gaddy of the Sing Campaign, and now we're actually speaking with Andrew Peterson on Thursday. I'm excited for that. And so he's coming to town. Just tell us a little bit more about the traveling campaign and as we wrap up here our time together.
Very quickly, sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Just the Sing Campaign. Your different artists are coming to different cities with this. Just, yeah, give us a sense of what we can look for.
Well, our tour begins in a few weeks' time. Andrew's only with us for the conference. Sorry, I want to explain that. Andrew's only with us for the Sing conference in Nashville, and you can watch it online. There'll be hundreds of thousands of people watching it on the streaming, so you can go to Getty Music or Getty Music Worship Conference and get the streaming of the event there. And then in the fall, we started touring. The first half of each night is Psalms, and the second half is the Gospels.
Well, so grateful for your work, Keith. We'd love to have you on again as you're writing more music moving forward. To your point that just music really can stand the test of time and anchor us deeply within our community. So thanks for taking the time this morning to join us on Faith Radio Mornings.
Thank you very much. I enjoy your time with Andrew.
We'll take a short break here for Lighten Up and Bottom of the Hour News, and more to come with the second half of our first hour as Kent Kaiser joins us in studio to talk through some of the news headlines of the day. So I enjoyed that conversation with Keith Getty and just the importance of worship as being so central to our faith. I know, again, that sometimes during a 45-minute sermon or even a 20-minute sermon, I can lose track of my way. Even if I'm the one giving the sermon, I get bored at times. And so in terms of just the worship and calling into this life of faith, there's something that does anchor us all the way back to King David when he danced through Jerusalem with the Ark of the Covenant coming in. And just this sense of worship of God, it's such a beautiful invitation. A lot more to come here on Faith Radio Mornings. We'll be joined by Kent Kaiser in a few minutes, and we'll talk through some of the major news headlines of the day, including the idea that our president is suggesting that Google may be out for him. Lots more to come on Faith Radio Mornings. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Dr. Rosemary Stein, and she was talking about the importance of just really being with our kids.
The knowledge that God is with you every time, and that this is a purposeful task that we're going through, really does bring a lot of hope. It doesn't just bring hope to teenagers. It brings hope to the parents, which in turn, when the child sees how the parent responds to life, then the child will already have a map. And that builds hope in the child. I mean, they should be able to see, okay, my mom, when she's going through something that's difficult, something that's trying, doesn't seem to break down. And that's the one thing that I see a lot at the clinic, is that when mom breaks down, the children break down. When mom is resilient, the children tend more to be resilient. And so they pattern themselves after us. And they should be able to see a kind of a map, a kind of an image of how they should act in turn.
It's a great conversation with Dr. Stein yesterday. She's so insightful when it comes to parenting our kids, and just holistically, but physiologically and relationally, spiritually. If you want to catch that entire segment, you can head to myfaithradio.com, search for Dr. Stein or parenting, and you'll find the full 16-minute segment there. Well, Kent Kaiser has just stepped into the studio. He has got his tie on. It's first day of teaching. He's the chair of communications department here at Northwestern, and lots to talk about with the headlines of the day in a minute on Faith Radio Mornings.
There's nothing quite like a new beginning, a fresh start, and today may just be your day. This is Jim Garlow. Your heart may be crying out, wait a minute, life's got to be a little bit more full than this. A number of years ago, I attended a support group. A man slipped up behind me, put his hand on my shoulder and said, you've come to the right place. Pretty comforting words. You may need a new beginning. Maybe you know the Lord, but you've wandered away. Well, the old fire isn't burning there anymore. You're realizing there's more to life than what I'm experiencing. This is your day of a new beginning. Before the foundations of the earth, God knew you'd be listening. God knows your need this very moment, and He says, come to me, and I will give you rest. You've come to the right place. This is Jim Garlow. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
And of course, those bagpipes signal the entrance of Dr. Kent Kaiser here on Faith Radio Mornings. Kent is the chair of the communications department at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, has worked on political campaigns in the course of his life as well. And you, not only are we listening to bagpipes, but you got the green tie this morning on, and a representative, the first day of class. You're all dressed up. I mean, it's very Irish and very professional of you, you know, Kent. And so, you know, what do you got?
Unlike the rest of the summer when I dragged myself in here in shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah, those are my favorite. Well, and you start classes today. You've got how many classes that you're teaching for the students today?
I have three today and one tomorrow.
Yeah, what do you teach? What's the first class of the
communication theory? It sounds boring, but it's actually kind of fun. So, yeah. This weekend, Pleasanton, California.
Tell us more.
Bagpipe band competition.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, so first weekend of school here, I get to fly out and do something fun.
So do you warm up? I mean, do you have to like puff your cheeks during the week? Or how do you warm up for the bagpipe competition here, Kent?
I just practice a lot. That's all. Just practice a lot.
Well, we love having you in here, studio, talk about some of the headlines of the day. And of course, from a communication standpoint, our president came out yesterday and had a few like surprisingly disparaging things to say about Google.
I think what Google and what others are doing, if you look at what's going on at Twitter, if you look at what's going on in Facebook, they better be careful because you can't do that to people. You can't do it. We have literally thousands and thousands of complaints coming in, and you just can't do that. So I think that Google and Twitter and Facebook, they're really treading on very, very troubled territory.
Well, so does the president have a point at all here in terms of what seems to be even soft censoring of his sort of platforms and ideologies? Is there really this reality going on in our platforms?
Well, it's going on. I don't know if there's anything one can do about it. I mean, they've admitted at Twitter and Facebook that their staff lean liberal. And so when they're screening things out, because they do, they didn't used to. This is what's interesting to me about Twitter. When Twitter first started, it was supposed to be this free market of ideas and unfettered access and so on. And now it's like the opposite of that. They actually block people who put out, well, not only what they call hate speech, but things that are conservative or inflammatory. And I mean, that's really the definition of free speech. I mean, free speech is the ability to say or write whatever you want. And so as soon as they start censoring that, I mean, you know, especially since a lot of it's not hurting anyone, it wouldn't potentially hurt anyone, but it's just a conservative viewpoint. But they see it as inflammatory, and so they block it from Twitter and Facebook. And it's interesting, if you're on Facebook particularly, they've said that if you are a conservative, you will see only conservative messages. I mean, in a way, and if you're liberal, the opposite. What they're doing is creating more polarization, because now we don't see the other side's points of view at all. And when we do, it's so rare, it's like we recoil from it or whatever. And so the president has a point. And with Google, you know, the algorithms are such that, you know, if you put in, you know, his name, what he's pointing out is that you get all these negative stories that float to the top, and there isn't much balance to it. And so that's what he's talking about. It's all happening. We know it's happening. The companies admit that it's happening. But what can be done about it? I have no idea. It just seems to me like the president has a point in that they ought to shape up, because if they don't, it seems to me that some alternative media is going to come up, which is exactly what happened with the legacy media, the old media, with television. You had these liberal-leaning mainstream, I guess you want to call them, but liberal-leaning news sources, ABC, CBS, ABC, and then Fox popped up.
Yeah.
And something like that could happen in the, you know, internet world, where there would be an alternative platform where conservative, particularly viewpoints, could go. Because it seems like it is the conservatives who are complaining the most. Now, recently, there's been some claim that these companies have become so afraid of regulation that they've swung the other direction. So you actually have liberals saying that now there's a conservative bias, that they're pro-conservative. I have not seen that myself, and I'm highly suspicious that it's not happening. But you could have a platform that would arise that would be specifically for particular ideology, and the president's got a point there. I mean, that's the free market. That could happen.
Yeah, and that speaks to just the increasing polarization that you mentioned, is that we begin to sort of reinforce what we already believe, because what gets targeted to us after we search for a little while become the same kinds of news items and the same kinds of feeds, and we just get looped in to this ongoing news cycle where we only begin to read that which we care about.
That's right, and so it just sort of becomes an echo chamber.
It really does. And, the stats are that 97% of people, when they do a Google search, don't make it past the first page of Google. And Google is not just a neutral purveyor of information. They really have these sophisticated algorithms that of what pops up on that first screen. And it's often what they seem to be deeming the most reliable information or the most relevant information, or often the most paid for information, is what makes it to that first page. So we're not talking about a neutral page of information that's on that first page. So they really do control how we think.
That's exactly right.
So in terms of what would you suggest to your students that you do with that? Do you just sort of make a practice or a discipline to going to page 6 of Google and seeing what's there?
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, students rely on it a lot, and, you know, it's difficult to suggest alternative media, because that's work. You know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like I say when I'm on, for example, Twitter, I have very specific reporters and news outlets that I follow. And that's what I usually suggest they do is and to get a more complete diet to follow different ones, different ideologies, ones that you know. But see, it takes research to know what's different, what's a different ideology and so on. I mean, and follow some foreign news sources. And it's interesting to see what's on the agenda outside the United States. I mean, I follow a couple of Canadian news outlets, one that's very liberal and you know, you get a different perspective, but you also have to be able to digest all of that.
Yeah,
it's
really
work.
It is. It's very hard work. We actually have a guest coming up in the second hour, Cal Thomas, who writes about liberal bias. And we're going to talk about just going back and forth between, you know, maybe watching BBC a little bit or going to Al Jazeera or, to your point, a Canadian news source. That I know my wife, Hallie, and I try to make a practice. If there's a news story that's popped up, we'll watch a little bit of the coverage from CNN and a little bit from Fox News. It becomes very obvious that there's an angle to these stories, but at least to get some kind of balanced perspective.
Right. And oftentimes they are, in fact, talking about the same story. So in terms of the agenda, they're often talking about the same topic. It's just the frame, the perspective that they take on the particular topic.
Yeah. Well, lots more to get to in the news. Before we take a break, I would like to at least mention the idea that the president has been well known to be reshaping the judiciary of our country. And of course, we've got a Supreme Court confirmation proceeding coming up next week on the 4th of September. We'll see Judge Kavanaugh begin to enter those proceedings. But kind of behind the scenes, there's a huge reformation in the courts with new justices and new judges being appointed that are quite conservative.
It's true. In fact, the president has actually, what you might call, flipped a couple of circuits that were liberal and are now conservative. And he's making inroads in some of the ones who are still out there that are liberal. I mean, many listeners probably hear about the liberal rulings coming out of California, those courts on the West Coast. And there, it's not likely that the president is anytime soon going to flip that court, but he's already put a couple of conservatives in there. So at least you get the conservative dissenting vote, and that's important, or the dissenting opinion, I should say, with those justices. And those are important because oftentimes those dissenting opinions are the ones that spur on cases that get taken up to the Supreme Court and become sort of the basis for what's argued in front of the Supreme Court. And obviously with a conservative Supreme Court, then those dissenting arguments become very powerful and compelling in their decisions at the Supreme Court level. So even when the president isn't actually flipping one of those circuit district courts, he is nevertheless having a huge impact.
It's Dr. Kent Kaiser, the chair of communications department here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. Take a short break, and Kent, when we come back, I want to ask you some questions about Trump's interactions with evangelicals. He just welcomed a number of them to the White House. We'll play some clips and get some perspective from you next on Faith Radio Mornings. It's 11 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapster, joined in studio, as we are often here on Wednesdays, by Dr. Kent Kaiser, the chair of communications department at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. And Kent, you walked into studio this morning and you handed our producer, Logan, a gift, a card. What is happening? And I mean, are you just ignoring me? You know, I'm a little bit of a diva, so I need to have your attention and gifts like this, Kent.
Well, it's payback because he comes down and helps us out with stuff. So,
All right. Well, so Logan, I guess, you know, there is reason to get the gifts that you do. Maybe I just need to actually become other-centered like you are in order to make this happen.
And he's a poor recent college grad in that. So.
It's really true. It is amazing how far a dollar goes with Logan. Just, you know, keep that sound running smoothly. Well, Logan, we do have a clip from the president. He welcomed evangelical leaders to the White House in the last couple of days, and I think he understands the importance of courting the evangelical vote.
These are very special friends of mine, evangelical pastors and leaders from all across the nation. We welcome you to the White House.
And then he goes on to say this as he was thinking just about the importance of their interaction together.
As you know, in recent years, the government tried to undermine religious freedom. But the attacks on communities of faith are over. We've ended it.
Kent, it seems like the president understands full well the power of the evangelical vote. And he sort of seems to be, especially in the midst of these affair allegations that strategically, I would suggest the Democrats have brought forward and really tried to perpetrate in light of the midterms coming up. I mean, he's having to defend himself to evangelicals because of the affairs.
Yeah, I don't know if he's even having to defend himself all that much. I think most evangelicals, I mean, what we're reading from across the country in terms of the polls and things is that the support hasn't diminished at all among evangelical voters. And I think for most of us, it's about the end game. And so he might not be the most polished or the most, you know, the leader that we would have chosen in terms of his style or anything else or his history and things. But when you look at the end game, like we were just talking about with the courts, I mean, that's what a lot of people voted on in the last election. They were voting for a Supreme Court justice, not for the president. And in fact, now they're getting a second Supreme Court justice, and they're getting the reformation of the federal court system in general. And so those are the things. And then also he is defending religious freedom. I mean, it is remarkable all the things that the Obama administration rammed through in the last few months, even, but throughout their administration, that were anti-religion, anti-religious freedom, and really infringed on religious rights. I mean, things like requiring Catholic nuns to dispense birth control when they disagree with birth control in the first place, and whatever one thinks of using birth control, but just forcing somebody to do something against their religious beliefs like that is got to rub everybody wrong, I think. And it's just, and it was one thing after another like that with the previous administration, just chipping away at religious freedoms. And here we have this president who's come in to restore those religious rights. And they are nevertheless always in peril. And we kind of know that. We know that if a different administration were to come in, they could go back to the kinds of things that Obama was doing. The president has only so much power if you know, in terms of proclamations and so on, and it's not law, so it can easily be undone, unfortunately. And so that's what we have to be, you know, we have to be vigilant about that. But, you know, I think for most evangelicals who are looking at this president, yeah, they think this guy isn't exactly who we would have chosen in terms of style or history, but what he's doing in terms of policy is exactly what we want. So it looks like in terms of the polls that we see, the support is not eroded.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult because he is, I think, acknowledged by all camps to not exactly be a model of virtue. And so, you know, to what extent do we sort of have to hold our nose if you're a supporter of the president to get to the policies? Because there really is a significant culture war going on relative to the future of our country.
Well, it is a broader culture war. It's not just a religious freedom and that. It's things like abortion. It's things like immigration. It is things, even tax policy and trade policy and so on. That all gets wrapped up in it. And so far, as we're going through the primary season here, we're coming up to an election. As you go through the primary season, even went through some primaries yesterday where the pro-Trump people won in their primaries. Now, will they win in the general election? That's another question. But it's not as though being on the president's side has become a negative for anybody on the Republican side. If anything, the support is stronger with the base than it has been up until now.
Yeah, the recent polls are 90% of Republicans support the president, which is higher than almost any other Republican president in history at this point. So it's fascinating to watch the media accounts versus what his base really seemed to be. And down in Florida, to your point, the candidate that he supported blew away the other one, and it should have been an upset, but it was actually no contest.
Right. No, and you got to question again whether is this actually support for the president or for the policies that are behind it. And you got to believe that the people are really worried about the policy. And so that's what I think they're supporting. I don't think if you ask the average Republican voter, like, you know, do you really like how Trump acts? Do you really like Trump's background? They're not going to say yes. They'll say that they like that he's a maverick, that he's shaking things up. But more often than not, you're going to hear them say that they appreciate that he is defending traditional American values.
Yeah.
And that's what you're going to hear.
And on the flip side of it, the candidate for Democratic governor that won last night is very much an avowed socialist. So here we see again that there really does seem to be a legitimate rise of socialistic ideals. And so this polarization is getting further and further apart.
Well, yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in general elections this fall, because we do have a number of really left-wing candidates running. And, you know, if any of them wins, then, you know, that'll be something, you know, to be concerned about, I suppose, for the future. But I think that what probably will happen is that will get batted down for now. And so we'll have more people who are pro-Trump getting elected, I think.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a difficult message for the Democrats when the economy is moving forward at a 4% plus pace. And in the meantime, you have the headlines coming out of Venezuela about the collapse of socialism. That's going to be, I mean, if you were on a Democratic campaign, how would you try to position moving forward in this?
Yeah, it's very difficult for them at this point. And I think that that's part of what the Democrats, I think, in some sense, in some of these races, are just throwing their hands up and saying, yeah, might as well put up a socialist, got nothing else to lose, you know, because they think they're not going to win anyway.
Yeah, well, it's Kent Kaiser, the chair of the communication departments here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. Kent, so you said you're flying out this weekend to head to a bagpipe contest of some kind. So how does this work? Do you all stand up with your bagpipes and it's sort of last person standing?
We march in. It's a group activity, so it's our band that's judged by, you know, experts. And so, yeah, we do this as a group. There are solo competitions. I'm not doing any of those, but we compete on Saturday and Sunday as groups and different kinds of music that we play. Yeah.
If you've got some video clips of this, we'd love to see it next week here on Faith Radio Mornings. Appreciate you joining us, and have fun with your first day of classes today in the communication area.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll come back and wrap up the first hour of our show here on Faith Radio Mornings. Such a fun conversation with Dr. Kaiser each morning here on Wednesday mornings on Faith Radio. I love that he does the bagpipes thing. I had the opportunity to go to graduate school in Edinburgh in Scotland, and one of my favorite things was to walk through the city from our flat to the university each morning. And in the center of the city, they would play bagpipes, and I would just stand there and watch these gentlemen in kilts blow on what is just a profoundly interesting instrument. And to the point of our first guest, it really does. The music just hits us at the center of our soul, and it was wonderful to walk through the city. Lots more to come in the second hour here on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.